And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jonathan Dog McKenzie. There he is. It is JJ Bull the Bullard.
Hello.
Hello there, right?
Yeah.
And look who it is, a special guest, a special milky treat for all of us here, Brits. We can see it's a real-life German. It's our guten Tag, Herr Stafford Blau, wie geht's?
Yeah, me gates is good.
Yes, they are. Silky, smooth, silver gates. Here to talk about football today with us in the gang. Brighton, of course, beating Arsenal. Is it funny? It is funny, but is it really funny? We'll find out later. It is funny. Now, will Man City win the league every year until Guardiola leaves? I don't know. But again, we won't find out for sure here today, but we will find out what JJ Bull thinks about that. And what else? Some really quite graphic analogies between Southampton's relegation, yes, and carving up of dead animals. Okay, there was a discussion of dead animals, the innards of a body. Of an animal body.
I thought it was mostly a person you were talking about.
Yeah,
was it a person?
That was how I felt.
Were there people in there? Well, no, yeah. All of the animals.
I didn't hear animals at all. You were mostly talking about a person.
A people? I think I said animal a couple of times.
I don't think you said anything.
I think you said animal without really meaning it.
Yeah, we're all animals.
Do animals have gallbladders?
Yeah.
Do they?
Pretty sure.
Humans have gallbladders and they're animals.
Yeah, I mean, we're all... I think mammals have gallbladders.
Does a leopard have a gallbladder?
Does a leopard have a gallbladder, Steve?
It produces acid
to help reduce the
bile. Is that right?
Bile. It produces bile to help the digestive system.
And these things actually digest. So
I used to have this little cuddly toy. Me and my sisters used to have these little cuddly toys. And one was a leopard, this lovely little cute thing. And you squeeze its belly and it would go, "Rawr! I'm a leopard." Well, I always think about that.
True. Septic. Can we get a little Rochelle sort? There he goes. Well, cows have four stomachs. Anyway,
yeah,
we'll wait to hear.
Do they have four gallbladders?
I don't know. We'll find out from Steve when we get to the end of the podcast. And that's right, of course, Steve may be taking a little longer than he normally would to look this up because he did fall off his chair halfway through the show. And we were a bit worried for a second that he might have seriously hurt himself. But he didn't. We talk about Star Wars and Lord of the Rings, but with Land Rovers. Sergio Busquets leaving Barcelona. We whip through the second legs of the Men's Champions League semi-finals. And, of course, we discuss John's visit to Wembley to watch the promotion playoff final where Notts County joined Wrexham in promotion from the National League. There we go. Have you found it?
Leopards have gallbladders.
They do.
Yes.
Wow, you're so excited to find that.
Yeah.
It was the perfect timing, wasn't it? Yeah. It's good. There we go. They do have gallbladders, yeah?
Do you want to see a picture of one?
A leopard's gallbladder?
Yeah.
Specifically a leopard's gallbladder?
Yes. That's on an ultrasound.
That's a picture of an ultrasound.
How really, have they managed to ultrasound a leopard?
It has to be really quick.
Yeah. I'm not sure how they did it.
Coming through the jungle, you've got all those equipment like...
You run alongside it and hold it on. You have to put the jelly stuff on them, don't you?
Why, I oughta. Yeah. Yeah, you have to put the jelly on the leopard. How'd you catch it? It's all jelly. Oh, no.
I don't know about the techniques, but knowing that a leopard is a notoriously tough judge of character, I expect that the doctor must have been ultrasound.
Okay. That's the worst joke I think I've ever heard.
Well, on that note, let me tell you about The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO. Theathletic.com/TIFO, where you won't find that many jokes, because to be honest, I would say in the of the whole sort of staff of writers here, there's four or five who are genuinely funny. And the rest, they're not funny people. They're not. But you know what they make up for? How they make up for a lack of funniness?
Excellent writing.
Rigorous journalism. They really do. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO. Theathletic.com/TIFO when you're not in the mood to laugh. Now, I will leave you today in...
The jelly hands. of a leopard.
In the jelly hands.
Pause.
And the ultrasound embrace.
And the ultrasound embrace of a...
A leopard's gallbladder, surely, right?
Of a leopard's gallbladder.
Covered in jelly.
Jellied bladder.
Chasing it through the jungle with a machine. And a Land Rover.
To begin, of course, other than Arsenal 0, 3 Brighton and Hove Albion. Now that's funny, isn't it? Because Steve Hanke looking at me through the glass there, he says, don't do it. Don't make fun of Arsenal fans because it's not their fault, is it? It's not their fault. It's their team's fault because they bottled it. Yeah? Not true. Now we're going to discuss here today, was it a bottle? Was it not? I think that's an interesting question, one that will perhaps haunt all of those players and the fans, indeed, for the rest of time. Because, of course, they did lose 3-0 to Brighton. And that's funny. But is it all funny? Yeah? We're going to find out. What do you think?
I think it's very much not funny.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. What do you think, Seb?
He's a Spurs fan. He thinks it's funny.
Hey, as a Spurs fan, I don't like the term bottled.
No.
I reject it. I feel like it's a social media term used to antagonize people.
I think that's true.
Also, it seems to... It's a little bit disingenuous because it ignores the era that we're currently in. The massive power of Man City, the ability to compete over multiple different competitions over a long period of time.
Yeah.
The strong bench, the ability to survive injuries, the ability to field an Erling Haaland throughout most of the season.
The ability to get anywhere near with such thin depth.
You know what I think also is the City have created a standard in the Premier League which is so high, so high, so high that to be able to match it for any length of time is going to fracture most teams.
For sure.
In fact, if you look at Liverpool, who I don't think it's controversial to say we're probably well beyond where Arsenal currently are, or you know, we're further on their ascent than Arsenal currently are. Look what it did to them. Look what 3 years of chasing City did to them.
True.
It's difficult. It's not the 90s anymore. It's not the 2000s. City are probably going to pass a 90-point threshold, and that's going to be quite an average accomplishment for them,
yes,
which is the context. So that's an extraordinary standard.
So what you're saying is it is funny.
In private, in my lighter moments, when I'm by myself, I do find it funny.
I think this is a key question, though. I start the podcast in jest asking this. But to be honest, if we're all honest with ourselves here, this is the way that a majority of football fans engage with it.
Yeah.
And the question this week is it funny or not? And you've just set out a case for it really not being funny and actually kind of being sort of scary.
Because we've, as a fan base, Tottenham have suffered much the same thing. When Tottenham finished second, when Tottenham finished third, and they competed with teams who outspent them, it was hilarious to everybody when they failed, because that's the nature of fandom. It's about
you lost out to Leicester.
Yeah, but
you didn't outspend you. Come on, you're really
okay. But then
milking
it's
the narrative.
Leicester's fair enough, but then lost out to Chelsea, or Spurs have spent the majority of the kind of the post millennium Premier League era competing with teams that have a wage spend which is 2 or 3 times them what they're able to spend. Forgetting also what they're able to, or what they're willing, probably is the better word, to spend. Recruiting players in the first place. And so the idea that competing and then failing to cross the line when you do.
I think overall, though, what you're saying is
it's annoying.
You empathize.
It's annoying to be told you're bottling it when actually, if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd have greatly enjoyed the season because I've seen my team compete in a way they haven't done for a really long time.
Yes.
For a lot of Arsenal fans, if you're a 20-year-old Arsenal fan, you probably haven't seen a season like this, really.
I mean, you definitely haven't.
Well, no, you'd have been alive, but you wouldn't have been cognizant of what it meant.
You were just a tiny baby.
And so what happens is you have all these good moments. I think of... I know the Reece Nelson goal against Bournemouth and some of the best performances. They were fantastic at White Hart Lane when they battered Spurs. They were great. And so what you have is that package of good moments and somebody putting on this big negative bow going, bottled it.
Yeah.
And it's annoying.
That is annoying.
Lots of things can be true though, right?
Of course.
I think all of this is true, but they also bottled it.
Okay, well, let's investigate more specifically. And we're going to come to JJ as well. I've got in front of me the list here of points from the 9th of April when they drew 2-2 with Liverpool at Anfield.
And that's not even including when they dropped points against Brentford and Everton.
No, of course, there were points dropped prior to that. They weren't a perfect team before that, but this is really the more recent spat. from which they took 9 points from a possible 21. Now, included there was obviously the 2 points dropped against Liverpool, 2 points at West Ham.
From a
two-goal lead. 2 points at home to Southampton. They lost away to Man City, which I think is very understandable. And obviously this weekend they lost 3-0 to Brighton. And so that is, 12 points dropped within that run. That's a huge swing to happen in such a short space of time. I mean, we're really talking about 5 or 6 weeks. Is that what you mean? I mean, bottled or not, like that's the tag that people will apply to it. But is that what you mean? That they've let points go there that a team that's challenging and expects to win the title can't lose?
There seems to be this narrative that if you're going to talk about bottling, you have to talk about the whole context of the season. And you say, well, you know, Arsenal weren't ever expected to challenge against Man City. And so the fact that they were even able to do that represents actually something that should be celebrated. And that is true.
Yeah.
But bottling for me is how you respond in the moments when you are in a pole position and how you behave on the basis of that. And I think it's clear from both those two spells, the one that happened in February as well, where they dropped points against Brentford and Everton. And then recently where, the title challenge is just completely eked away from them. And mm-hmm. I think, on the one hand, I've heard people say, well, if you look at the amount of points you expect Man City to get on average in a season, you look at the amount of points that Arsenal would expect to get on average in a season, and you look at the run that they've had, actually an 8-point gap, which was actually only a 5-point gap because of a game in hand, isn't actually that much to throw away. And I agree with that. But I also feel as though all that Arsenal had to do was win games against Everton and win games against Brentford, win games against West Ham, who have been like focusing on Europe, win games against Southampton, who could barely beat anyone recently.
Who've been relegated.
If you can't win those games, then okay, you will drop the occasional point against a team like that. And this season, Man City have done that. Man City have dropped points to Nottingham Forest and
and
Everton as well. And for me, the problem is the aggregation of those games together. It's that they've come in sort of spells where it seems as though they've actually made it harder for themselves.
It's also happened during a spell when Man City have won 11 Premier League games in a row.
Yeah, and we know that Man City are going to do that. They do that at the end of seasons. They pick up momentum and they go for it. But I think once you've had that first half of the season that Arsenal had, which is a 50-point first half of the season, that's an incredible first half of the season, and you put yourself in a really good position to then, you don't have to, you only have to be, I don't know what the point gap was at that point, but you only have to be that amount of points better than Man City, and they weren't. And so it's not even like they've just narrowly missed out to Man City. Now it will end up being like 7 or 8 points.
Yeah, right. Which is a fair old gap. What do you think, the Bullard?
About?
I mean, did you listen to any of the conversation?
Lots of it. Yeah.
Just any thoughts you could add?
I think that exactly what John says, that they didn't win games they should have won. They had the advantage, they had the lead. I think you can point to things like there's that game against Liverpool where they say that the flaring point was when Granit Xhaka had a little dig at Alexander-Arnold, and the Anfield crowd suddenly got all nuts, and that's when they start to lose it. And you can see that's maybe pressure, but then they've clearly missed individual players. Like Saliba's made a big difference to their defence. The defence is a really important part of how you play. Their numbers have not been as good, I think, post-World Cup as they were before. Was that right? I think. And so that's just kind of what happened. And then they've made little mistakes here and there. And like Ramsdale's looked not quite as sturdy the last few weeks. That
he's
could
had a
be pressure.
A couple of weeks, isn't he, Ramsdale?
It could just be pressure. Like, you don't know what it's like to compete at that level. Mm-hmm. And you're competing against one of the greatest, if not the best, Premier League side that's ever existed. But as for this thing where like City are going to dominate the league forever, like Man United used to do that. It was the same thing. Like they used to, those of us who grew up in the 90s, all of us, do you remember? It was always Man United. They won everything. It's like, this is an absolutely pointless league. It's always Man United.
Did they ever win 5 in 6?
They go Man United. So it starts in 1993 when football was invented. You had Man United after that. Blackburn, randomly. 92, but the season finished in 93.
Oh,
And then, so they won 4 of the first 5.
Yeah.
Then they won, so then Arsenal won after that, 97, 98. And then you had Man United won 3 in a row, then Arsenal, then Man United, then Arsenal, then Chelsea, because that's when the Abramovich money comes in. And everyone's like, oh, Chelsea are going to ruin it. 2 seasons of that, then Man United 3 times in a row. Mm-hmm. It was all Man United. It's the same. It's just because Pep Guardiola has done an incredible job with that Man City team. Yes.
Do you think when Pep leaves, they won't dominate?
Yes. I think that's exactly what will happen. It'll change completely. They'll get people in who will do well with them. they have great players, but look at the players they've signed. They weren't all absolute superstars. They weren't signing Galacticos, you know, like Real Madrid have done in the past. They signed players that suit the system, that are just trying to get to that next level. Pep makes them better, and they work in a system that's very it works very well right now. But again, as tactics evolve and teams will change, that will then turn something else later on. Like Liverpool, when they were pushing City, when they won the league during the pandemic time, didn't they? We're unbelievable, like the best I've ever seen Liverpool, one of the best teams I've ever watched, that Jurgen Klopp team. But it's maybe unsustainable because of just the relentless amount of energy they want to use. And yes, they're competing against City, but I mean, United were against the best ever Arsenal going all the time, and that was one of the things they had. Then they had Mourinho's Chelsea to go against. That was really difficult. Man United didn't manage that 2 years in a row. Then they came back. Once Alex Ferguson goes, it falls apart. I think we'll see something very similar at Man City. They won't go the way that Man United did. I'm not saying that. But they'll suddenly be either winning league one season or two seasons in a row. Then there'll be a break. And so
How far are this Arsenal team off those historic teams that you're referencing there? You know, Mourinho's Chelsea, the Arsenal Invincibles. Are we? I mean, I guess it depends on what they do next season. But do you think there's a scenario where we look back and think of them as a team like that? Or are they not there?
I think Arsenal have, like, I think we all know they're well ahead of schedule, because they're not meant to be where they are now. So if they'd won it, it would have been an incredible achievement to have done it. So they're at the point now where they want to be in the Champions League. That is part of the plan. And I think comparing it to how Klopp transformed Liverpool, it took him a good few years, but 3-4 years before they were 20. And they did that by signing really key players and then developing what they were working on, getting better at it. People might, I think other teams, me and John were talking about this a bit earlier, teams might have figured out what Arsenal do now, and so they know how to stop it. But Arsenal maybe run out of that energy and intensity, and their key player, the equivalent of Van Dijk, is Saliba. So missing out on that in this stage of the season is really important.
Tomiyasu as well, losing him. Because I was watching just loads of depth, yeah. You're thinking Spanning, like you sorry. Have the option to shut down a winger with a fullback who's kind of defensively orientated. When that goes, you got a kind of imperfect solution in that area. And that kind of feels a little bit typical of where the Arsenal squad is at the moment. Just
there's,
missing
there's
one
more size to that though, because they do have good players come in. Like Zinchenko's a big loss, right? You want to play that inside midfielder fullback slot that is everywhere. But Tierney's a great left back, so then you get something else out of that. You can change it.
I don't know if he's a great left back. He's quite good.
He's a great left
back. He's a solid 7 out of 10 Premier League player.
He'll play for Newcastle next season and be unbelievable.
Nathan Ake, people would have described as being a worse player than Kieran Tierney. And this is part of the problem. Is it's always hard to judge what level players are at when, you know, a player's quality emerges from the system that they're being played in. And that's why Pep Guardiola is so good, because he is able to bring in these players who people think of as being lesser, get more quality out of them because the system works for them. And then what ends up happening inevitably is we end up with a system where people say, well, you know, Guardiola has all of the best players. But actually what's happened is that Pep Guardiola has the best system. Yeah. He's brought the players in and it brings more out of them.
And that's why you're such a staunch proponent of communism, isn't it?
That's right.
Do you not think that, like, stability is a massive factor here? Because
in communism, I agree.
In communism, but also Manchester City. Because like,
okay, both, yeah.
With clubs in that sort of stratosphere of finance before, what you typically expect is high turnover, both of players and coaches, because there's too many egos. So you think of PSG, for instance. I think what City have done really well, apart from talent ID, is the type of characters who they've brought in have aided that stability. No, you don't.
Well, they've
kept
it about the fatherland. They've not made it about.
Well, I wasn't going to go towards that. No, but right. I was going to say that one of the reasons why City have become so formidable is because Guardiola has been there for such a long time. Whereas originally you thought that'll last 3 years, in the same way that Mourinho's Chelsea did, or anyone at PSG can only really last 18 months because emotionally it's just far too much of a grind to deal with that many egos in the same place. City have found this balance between, like John says, players who can come in and be stars, who understand that their stardom is a little bit dependent on their environment, and so as a result don't agitate for more. And obviously there's a financial aspect to that, but that's why it's so difficult, because they don't have these peaks and troughs. We're talking about 90 Premier League points in a season being kind of average.
Yeah.
You know, because we know that they're capable of 101.
Yeah.
And that's a very high bar, first of all, to get to. But then if their down years are 85 points to 90, well, you don't really capitalise on that so much.
Sure.
The left-back position for Man City is a really interesting example of this, right? Because they start off the season with Joao Cancelo playing at left-back. Everyone's like, you know, one of the best left-backs in the world. He leaves for Bayern Munich midway through the season, and because they've been playing Nathan Ake is this sort of in the sort of weird hybrid role between an outside centre-back and a full-back. Nathan Ake gets injured, and they end up moving across Manuel Akanji to the other side. Manuel Akanji was playing on the left-hand side of their defence against Real Madrid in the Bernabeu. Now, like, we can have this conversation about Arsenal all we want and say, oh, you know, they've not got Zinchenko, they've only got Kieran Tierney. But Man City went from losing João Cancelo to having Nathan Aké, who had a really good season, but no one really expected that of him, to now Manuel Akanji, who people thought was washed when he was at Borussia Dortmund. So I think that the context does change the way that we think about what those players are at. And I think that's always used as a stick to beat Pep Guardiola, because they say, well, he has all of the money and all of the best players. But I genuinely think that we don't have these conversations about Man City because Pep always manages to get the most out of the players that he ends up having to play. They've used I think, one of the smallest squads this season in a season where they've been in every competition for ages. You know, that there's a level of impressiveness to it, and whilst I think that level of impressiveness is, you know, tarnished by the undercurrent conversations that you have about it, it's still intrinsically impressive what he has done with the things at his disposal, the players at his disposal, the fact that he can constantly innovate. I mean, we talked about Spurs like had a really nice period under Pochettino, got really good, didn't actually develop the squad and fell away. Same sort of happened with Liverpool a little bit recently as well. And I think that's the thing that that Pep Guardiola is really good at, is constantly innovating, constantly bringing players in, letting players go. Like, we're going to talk about Ilkay Gundogan, and the big conversation is going to be he's got two really good goals in the game against Everton. Now everyone's saying should City keep him on? They have an option to trigger a year.
He did also score two goals last weekend and last year, I think, was against his record goal scoring season.
No, but the point I'm making here is that. Yeah. What will probably happen is that City will have a very clear idea of what context they want to keep him in. And if he doesn't fit that, they'll move him on.
The perspective that fans would normally take of football and footballers is this player is good or this player is not good. And that's not how Pep Guardiola would look at it.
I don't think he'll have been impacted by Gundogan scoring four goals in the last two games to then go, well, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to change all of the plans that we've had, keep him in.
Sure.
Actually, what will probably happen is he will still move on if he doesn't agree to fit into the system that City have. John, and then bring someone else in, right?
Can I be contrary and describe that as a little bit of a privilege too? Just because, like, the opportunity to say, well, you're out of contract, we don't need to sell you. From a City perspective, we sell you when we want to, or we let you go when we want to, because we don't need the resale value from you. So you're able to deal with the succession planning in a much more precise way to say, what's a good example? Right, the Kane situation at Spurs. If Kane was a Manchester City player heading into his final year of the contract, he'd be like, oh, fine, let him go for free. Spurs have to potentially take a self-defeating position this summer or next summer, because financially that's what they need to do to compete or reload in a way that might allow them to compete in 2 or 3 years' time. So it's kind of, I think they're kind of separate conversations. On the one hand, lots of good decisions. Guardiola's management of this squad and this club has been excellent.
It's worth dropping in here, though, Seb, that in the summer, Akanji was signed for 17.5 million
100%.
Euros, right? I mean, it's not like I don't seek to defend a team that currently has 100 charges against them, right? But my point is, in terms of like the actual management of the squad, it's not like every player's been brought in for 100 mil.
No, absolutely. And City have never done this. They've never spent the kind of the £150 million transfer fee. They've actually done it in much smaller chunks, just in volume. And actually the concentration of their spending was actually probably towards the beginning relative to what the game was at the time. But then both things can be true. Like, their talent is great. Their integration of players is very, very good. They have very few failures. And yet at the same time, they can afford to have the failures, which is you know, which creates, I would imagine, hesitancy in other clubs that City don't necessarily have to worry about.
And what you're saying is, it is funny. That's the thing, right?
We're back to Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, subjectively, you're a funny guy, JJ.
He is a funny guy.
It's funny subjectively.
Yes.
Right? And can you explain more about that?
It's funny because Arsenal fans got really, really uppity and started being like, oh, you don't believe in Arsenal, you don't think we're going to do it.
All of them.
All of them.
Every single one.
Every last one.
Yeah.
Especially Steve Hanke.
Steve Hanke, the podcast producer. Yeah. Now, this is the thing. Arsenal fans listening to this very unhappy with us right now because it is funny. It is. But the reason we're doing it, it's not because of you. You don't matter to us at all. We don't think about you ever or care about you. Someone we do think and care about is Steve Hanke. And he's been very sad recently. He's in our little WhatsApp group, isn't he? We talk about football at the weekend. Sometimes you'll drop in a little message there. I'm hopeful that maybe Arsenal could win the league.
Do you know
and
what
we
it
go,
is?
And shush up, Steve Hanke. Get back in your cave.
It's been quite fun to watch Steve break character in the WhatsApp group because Steve's a very mild mannered, polite, friendly person.
Yeah.
Every
he's
now
very
and
on
again,
a level.
Big
isn't
Arsenal fan, though.
He is a big Arsenal fan, but at the same time, The undulations within the season have caused him to kind of
his bias
spike.
Really shows.
Well, there have been a few moments like that.
Big time.
I think I can tell you exactly why it is funny, because there's a sort of there's a bit of like tragedy in it.
Is it going to upset Steve?
No.
Oh.
But the thing is, like, so obviously I jest that all Arsenal fans are being jerks about it and being all, you know, angry and whatever.
We all knew that was a joke.
Yes, but many people at home will not know that. A lot of what I say is on purpose to be to wind you up.
I don't think the internet would ever take something out of context, JJ, so don't worry.
Sure. So anyway, so because a lot of Arsenal fans will have been those annoying ones who are like, you don't believe in us, you don't know anything, we know all this, we're going to win the league. And then there's a lot more very sensible, level-headed Arsenal fans who started to come over a bit towards that, maybe we could.
It's the movement of emotion. That's
maybe we
the
could.
Thing.
And you start to, you follow football and it's never going to happen again. You've been stuck post-Wenger, nothing's happening. Your life becomes slightly worse.
Well, those fans at the beginning of the season, they that you would say to them, it's a good team this year, isn't it? And they go, oh yeah, do you think so?
It's pretty good, but we'll never.
Your team's good as well.
Yeah.
And
well,
then
we'll
halfway
never achieve
through
anything.
The season, they'll be like, yeah, my team.
Halfway through, they start
good.
Thinking, maybe there is hope
but
in my
afraid.
Life.
But they're afraid.
You know, my life could be something else. I could achieve things if my team can do it.
As
boy, golly gosh.
Of me and my success.
Maybe I could get that job. Maybe I can get the partner I've always wanted. Maybe that there's a future for me.
Yeah.
And then they start to think, maybe this is all. Life is what I wanted it to be. And they start to dream and they let go of their ambitions, you know, and they start thinking, well, maybe I can dream.
Yeah.
And then they draw 3-3 with Southampton.
in life.
And then they draw 2-2 West Ham.
Yeah.
And they were winning.
Yeah.
And then you're like,
so it is funny.
I regret those things I said. Yeah.
No, it's,
and then that's why it's funny, because it's sort of a...
It's a dance of human emotion, isn't it?
I believe the Germans have a word for this, right? Is it?
That's funny!
That's right, yeah. That's it.
What is it?
Schadenfreude.
Schadenfreude.
That's what it is.
You love saying Schadenfreude.
I don't think I've ever said Schadenfreude.
I've heard you
podcast.
Say, no, not on this podcast, but I've heard you say it in real life. I would say over 100 times.
Absolutely.
It's
ridiculous.
A word I would associate with you.
I cannot remember the last time
I
used that.
I believe the Germans have a word for this. I think I'm getting it right when I say Schadenfreude.
Look, Schadenfreude is the most well known German word.
I know, because you've been saying it for so long. You've brought it here, haven't you, from all the way from Germany?
He's popularized
over
Schadenfreude.
Here to our normal English
no
people.
No one was saying Schadenfreude before I started saying it. It's
agree.
True.
It's weird is. That you've invented a German word and got the whole world to start saying it.
Poor,
you're not even the one
manto, just,
that lives in Germany.
I took two German words, I smashed them together,
smashed
and
them
I got
together.
Everyone using them. That's what
Speaking
happened.
Of taking two Germans and smashing them together, Pascal Gross is... is he German?
Who's he been, yeah, who's he been smashed
Is his
with?
Parents? His parents... I'm assuming is, I mean, Gross with the what do they call the thing? The
Esset.
The Esset. It looks very German.
You always use that word, don't I? I can't believe Esset. I use Esset again.
I assume Pascal Gross's parents are German, and they were the people I was smashing together to make Pascal Gross, who has played in a number of different positions, Jean McKenzie, this season. Just a perfect exemplar of Brighton's fantastic season, isn't he?
Yes, although he played in a fairly... Actually, he did move. He did move midway through the game, didn't he? Switched positions.
And that's why Steve Caicedo put it in the play.
Well, Caicedo played at right back, which I think is probably more
he was
unusual.
Great. I would have right gone straight to well. Caicedo, but I wasn't sure that his parents were German. And I
his,
didn't.
His
I didn't
parents was, almost certainly aren't German.
Well, I wanted to smash together two Germans to make a new German.
Okay.
So
I feel as though this is the most tortured metaphor we've ever used in a podcast. Probably
I can assure you it's probably not.
Let's talk about Moises Caicedo, because he played at right back in this game and did a
I want
good...
to stay on the smashing Germans. Imagine the what's the big tube where they fire protons round?
Oh, the Hadron Collider.
Yes, they should do that, but they should do it for German players.
And Pascal
Schweinsteiger one way, Philipp Lahm the other.
I think that's how they made Erling Haaland. They smashed Alan Shearer into a tube with...
Alfinger Haaland, presumably.
Yes. Yeah, that's what they did, yeah.
And a bit of Roy Keane's foot in there.
Yeah. You know, that was stuck in there still, yeah.
Just his DNA has that imprinted.
God, imagine if you put Schweinsteiger and Lahm together. That would be the most aggressive and most technically competent.
With AI, soon they'll be able to achieve this.
They will be able to.
They'll be able to reverse aging so you can get them both at their peak age. Then you can smash them together, put robot bits in, faster, stronger, leaner, smarter.
Now, listen, we were talking about Pascal Gross. We were talking about Moises Caicedo. Brighton, of course, winning 3-0. We did decide that it was funny. Moises Caicedo played it right back in this game, John McKenzie. Didn't know he could do that.
I think he's done it before. But
Well, I haven't seen it.
Last week, I think. Yeah.
Well, I don't watch Brighton.
I thought this was a really interesting game because I thought Brighton did things quite different to the way that they usually do. And I actually think Arsenal played quite well against Brighton yesterday.
Uh-huh.
I thought they pressed them pretty well and ended up with this situation where Brighton, the best bet they had was going long. And I guess you would hope against Brighton's forwards to be able to match them 1v1 because what is what they allowed at the back. Mm-hmm. They just ended up being the team who conceded first, and I think Brighton were the better team and had the better chances. Mm. But I think it was a lot more even than people are making out off the back of the result.
Right. I thought Brighton kicked them off the park. It was so aggressive; like they were just not giving them a single second of time or space.
Yeah. They played man to man out of possession, and you don't often see teams doing that. A lot of people were talking about Levi Colwill because he was tracking Ødegaard all the way up the pitch. And I thought that was kind of interesting because I felt as though with any other team, if an opponent goes man to man in those sorts of situations high up the pitch, the obvious thing to do is to just move them around and generate space for yourself. But didn't see Arsenal doing much of that, which I suppose maybe raises questions about whether or not Arsenal are too automated in their build-up play to a degree. We talk a lot about flexibility, but the beauty of going man to man is that when you use different shapes in build-up,
Steve Hanke has quite literally fallen backwards off his chair. Through there. I'm sure, I wonder if podcast listeners would have heard the sound of the thud of his skull hitting the wall there. Are you sure you're okay?
Yeah, but that wasn't good, was it?
No.
Were you tipping on your chest?
You've gone
right. I literally
right
didn't
over,
even lean that
you?
Far back in it, yeah.
Yeah.
See, that would have been... I'm annoyed I didn't find that funnier because I was worried he might have actually hurt himself.
Fainted. Yeah,
because normally someone falling off a chair is very, very funny.
Well, back to the subject, subjectively, what is funny and what isn't? I mean, in this sense, like Arsenal players, they haven't hurt themselves.
It's equivalent to them falling off a chair backwards, I suppose.
Yeah.
Without the hurting themselves.
Without the wall behind to smash the head
Only
against.
Their pride bruised.
Exactly, there's much hope ahead.
Kind of, is he okay?
Have you held up a finger for him, Don? Can he see your finger? Can he see your finger? Doesn't hurt his head, has he?
No, I'm fine. I didn't bash my head.
Yeah.
And also smashed the lovely black paintwork, though. So.
Okay. What's your middle name?
Patrick.
Okay.
Stephen Patrick Hankey. Stephen
S-P-H.
Patrick Hankey. No.
Okay, well, should we actually chronicle a workplace accident like that on the podcast?
I think we should, SPH. Yeah. I think we really should.
Yeah.
Can I carry on with what I was saying?
Of course you may.
I remembered what I was saying.
Spur is back in his chair.
When you build up in different...
Go on.
No, it's fine.
No, we want it.
No,
we wanted
to talk about Arsenal.
We wanted
anyway.
To hear it simply because
I don't want to talk about football.
I don't think they were ready to hear you, so that's why I stopped you.
Okay.
Hang on. What are you going to say? Go on.
I'm not doing this.
No, go on. Seriously.
Are you going to do it?
I'm not
going to
do it.
So when they...
I'll get away from the microphone.
So they use different shapes and build up, but usually when you use different shapes and build up, it's because the opposition use a very specific structure, and so by using a different shape in your build up, what you're attempting to do is pull that structure around. But if the opposition goes player for player, if you change system and structure in your build up, it doesn't make a difference because the same players are still following the same same markers. Clearly, like Arsenal are really well set up to deal with other teams maybe changing their pressing structures, but when they actually go to a man to man system, it's much harder to deal with. Now.
Right.
You can pull man-to-man systems apart really easily because Leeds used to play man-to-man and they used to get pulled apart really easily. But in a single game, it's worth a team like Brighton coming up and being like, let's just see how they respond to it. And I think they did cause Arsenal a few problems in the build-up. But I also think that Arsenal's pressing was really good against Brighton as well. They didn't allow them to build up through the middle, which is what they usually do. And they were only really getting out balls through going long. And they were able to force situations where they were able to get good chances, but not in the control way that they usually do it as well. So I thought it was quite a fascinating game in many respects.
Is this the peak for Brighton? How do they get better than this? Because I mean, you know, when Graham Potter left halfway through the season, Seb, everyone expected them to get worse, but they seem to get better under De Zerbi, who's done a terrific job. They're flirting around outside of the European position. I mean, is there a scenario where they can improve upon this, or are we looking at watching Brighton next season and feeling like it can only go down?
Well, I think if you added a dose more efficiency in at the top of the pitch, then you'd have something really interesting.
João Pedro.
Yeah, well, absolutely. João Pedro has joined from Watford and he's not quite developed yet, but could be a really, really good player. And De Zerbi was actually asked about him last week and he sounds very excited about having him there. I suppose almost asking what happens next at Brighton is kind of beside the point because that implies that they're in a sort of perpetual state of growth.
Yeah.
Whereas in reality, they're built to sort of regenerate and reset. You know, like where you smash an amoeba and it becomes two and then it's three. Yeah. And it's that kind of mentality.
For fans then, is this like, this is the season, or not the season, but this is a season where you're, this is the peak of your success. I guess what I'm saying is, should anybody be expecting them over the next 5 years to turn into a Champions League side?
I think they can be in the top eight over the next couple of years. But I think the point really is, think about where Brighton have come from. Think about what it'd be like to have been one of those people at the Goldstone Ground back in the 90s to see them survive potentially dropping out of the Football League by the skin of their teeth, to have come all the way up the leagues, to have gone through the Withdean Stadium and the kind of the, that weird athletics track and the, you know, the lack of roofs anywhere. To be on that journey and to get to a point yesterday where you play Arsenal off their own pitch in that stadium, I feel like as a symbol of what Brighton's regeneration has been, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And so, yes, they may win a League Cup, or they may get into the Champions League, or they might go on a Europa League run and go to all kinds of weird and wonderful places and, you know, dent the egos of clubs who have historically been much bigger and more prominent than they are. But as a as an experience, it's going to be pretty difficult to beat that. And also, and I think this is might relate a little bit to what we said about Arsenal earlier, I think it's really lovely to be one of those teams that people admire. So everywhere you go, if you're a Brighton fan this morning, you know, you meet a stranger, oh, who do you support? Brighton. People are going to say positive stuff, right? I love watching your team. I love watching Mitoma and Casado, the great players. And your manager's fun and he's aggressive and weird and volatile, but also coaches really, really attractive football. I think that's a fun place to be for a fan. I don't think it gets much better than that. And it doesn't last for very long, because just being upwardly mobile, eventually you get the kind of, right, get back in your place now, because you just upset a few too many people. It's got to be pretty great. I don't know as a fan how you take that to another stage beyond literal footballing development. It's got to be a pretty nice experience after everything they've been through.
Well said. Isn't it nice to have said back on the podcast? Yeah. You prick. Anyway, let's go to a break now, and when we come back, we'll have a brief chat about Ilkay Gundogan.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, what a lovely break. A little titter there, a little titter for the break. Now listen, JJ Bull, Ilkay Gundogan. Oh.
Ha!
Ha! Ha? Yeah?
Yeah.
Let's talk about Southampton now. Southampton 0-2 Fulham. Of course, they were relegated at the weekend. That's why we're discussing them here. But like what you do with anything that's dead, Seb, you carve it up. And you eat it, the flesh and everything, yeah? And the bones, and then all the liver, you know, all of the different organs of the thing, whatever it is that's been hit, you know, on the that's on the roadside.
I like Gundogan. I think he's really good.
He is good, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's brilliant.
What do you think about him?
Really important for City. One of their most, like, a really important player in the Pep Guardiola era as well. Has scored many goals from this midfield position, helps them run games with experience. Is quite an intelligent character by all. A lot of people seem to think he'll be a manager. When he retires,
he's got the look of a manager.
Yeah, he plays Football Manager a lot as well.
Does he?
He does, yeah. Which is all you need,
as we know.
As we know, yes. Yeah.
All of the organs and the blood and the skin and stuff. The skin, maybe you would have as a separate. You could make crisps out of it. I've seen people do that before. It's an animal. It's not a, you know, not a human being, but it's an animal that's been hit by a car on the roadside. And maybe you look at it and you think, well, that left lung that's been crushed by the impact of the car, but that right lung looks like it could score 4 or 5 free kicks a season, and actually that gallbladder, while it does offer no use inside of the body, actually it's a perfectly serviceable right back. Now, how do you, when you're carving it up, what are you, which bits are you eating?
Well, before I do any of that, I probably read Jacob Tanswell's excellent article on the last couple of years at Southampton. And
any blood in it?
In a figurative sense, lots of blood. Yeah. A real kind of, you know, The Shining type.
A spilling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like in one of those films where someone gets sliced and then the blood just inexplicably shoots out as though they were a Coke can.
No, so the way that Jacob described it was a little bit slower, the blood letting.
Oh.
Yeah. And the way he describes it is, well, first of all, a whole mess of poor decisions. And whilst there are useful components at Southampton and admired players, particularly admired young players, the situation he describes is one where probably there hasn't been quite enough deference to chemistry and kind of what human components you need within a football team.
Human components.
Yeah. And he also describes some fairly strange goings on with appointments and some sort of political difficulties in terms of how those appointments and decisions were being made.
Oh, I should read very, very this. Good, is very, this very is good on The Athletic.
Yeah, it's a very fine piece of work by Jacob. And I think most of us only really woke up to how bad the Southampton situation was about 6 months ago, 9 months ago. But Jacob describes something which has been in motion for quite a few years now, at least traces it back all the way to Ronald Koeman leaving the club.
Because the temptation is to think, well, they got rid of Hasenhüttl, who had never really achieved loads. But I mean, retrospectively, keeping Southampton in the Premier League for that number of seasons is a huge achievement. But the temptation is to kind of look at that being the point. But Jacob says it goes much further back.
Goes much further back. And I think one of the things that really jumped out from that article was the amount of good players that they supposedly were interested in, but who dallied or decided not to pursue. I don't want to steal Jacob's thunder. Do go and read the piece, but it's about 10 of them who think, yeah, that'd be pretty transformational. Had you done that? But no. And so when you see something like that, it's a multi-departmental failure. And I think anybody that's watched Southampton would probably say that that's what that looks like on the pitch.
All the organs stop working at once.
Well, yeah, because they don't work in concert. Yeah. It's not that necessarily all the organs are useless. Yeah. It's that in this instance, because, well, I mean, I think we all pretty much admire Romeo Lavia. And I think Bella Catchup will become a good player at one point.
Carl Walker-Peters there. We have James Ward-Prowse as well,
James Ward-Prowse, you'd imagine, will probably leave, yes.
Well, let's talk about that now. Yeah. John, I know you suggested giddily and in a sort of excited way last week that James Ward-Prowse should just go to Brentford.
Yeah, I mean, Brentford's set pieces are great. It would add another string to their bow in terms of being able to produce goals from those sorts of situations. So that would make a certain amount of sense, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You suggested Newcastle.
Well, I said Brentford.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I thought it was him.
The reason being that...
did you say Newcastle?
No, I said that as well.
You said all of this, yeah. And when I was having a conversation with you, I thought I was having a conversation with several people.
Yes. And sometimes maybe you were. the reason being for Brentford, like as John says, like they're the best set-piece team in the world, basically. So a set-piece coach told me, for example, that... a lot of when you're building your routines and stuff like that, so a lot of teams want to shoot from 25 yards, like kind of Beckham shot, because you think that's how you're going to score a goal because you've seen it happen. But it's very rare you actually score from that shot. So if you have a player like James Ward-Prowse, your job as a set piece coach is maybe easier, because then you can just tell him shoot because you can score the goals, and that's what you guarantee is the same sort of quality of strike all of the time. And there's a guy, was it the set piece kicking coach that I spoke to on a TIFA YRL video. Bartek Sivestrak, who is he's a kicking coach. So he's talked about how James Ward-Prowse is like one of the best kickers of the ball he's seen in pure technique.
Of a dead ball,
one you can carve up and eat. And so if you have James Ward-Prowse at Brentford, first of all, you can get a few more goals a season from 25 yards, as an example, if you were to go there. But also what you could then do is teams are going to set up to try and defend against specifically that, which then gives you loads more options for a set-piece routine from 25 yards if you want to. You also guarantee perfect delivery, near perfect, from corners and your wide areas, like wide deep and wide free kicks. So you can then come up with all sorts of things you want to do because you can guarantee the sort of delivery that you want for that. But then if you think of Newcastle, they might try and see value in trying to do the same thing sort of Brentford have done with all their set pieces, that they're amazing at Brentford. So Newcastle might try and think, well, maybe we don't want to spend, maybe they can't because FFP spend £150 million on players who can get them goals or whatever. So instead we'll get a player who guarantees us goals from set pieces rather than actually scoring them himself. And that might be why he might be attracted to that sort of club.
Mm, you said Newcastle as well, right?
That's what I just said there, yeah.
Were you just talking about Newcastle?
I was just talking about Newcastle there, which I said their club name a couple
checked
of times.
Out.
Yeah,
I was thinking about Alex Stewart.
Oh, yeah,
because he's a Southampton fan.
I was thinking about when in Star Wars, what is the point of the stormtroopers having the armor? Because they get shot they die with one hit all the time, but then all the other people get shot maybe a couple of times and they're all right. Yeah. I don't understand.
Well,
what the
that's about
is.
The quality of the character, isn't it?
But they would then develop surely armor that is to withstand the standard lasers.
You would think so, but
with.
Then also you know that the leaders of the Imperial Army, the people who make the clone army, what they actually want is for the clones to die in one.
The worst
hit
part
because
of,
that's
the worst
best
part of,
for the film.
The worst part of like the plot in the new Star Wars is when they just kill off all the Jedi. Like the whole point of the Jedi is they're like supposedly really hard to kill.
No.
And then they just have a couple of scenes where it's just like, yeah, we'll just kill.
We'll just get rid of those Jedis.
Doesn't Samuel L. Jackson go to like to try and get the Emperor and then the Emperor just kills like three Jedis all at once and they seem surprised. They're like, oh shit.
Because the Emperor
didn't expect the guy that we think actually might be a bad Jedi
a Sith Lord bad guy.
Yeah. To be actually dangerous.
Well,
and
he's
then,
just, yeah, I mean, it's a miscalculation, isn't it?
And then what they've done in the very last one that they made is they essentially made the whole thing about Rey just trying to kill her granddad. That's basically what the entire 9 films is about.
I really like them.
The second newest one was great, and the first one, the remake of New Hope, was really good. Yeah. But the second one everyone hated was amazing.
I found myself emotionally entangled with the characters.
I think they're good. I just think there's some holes in the plot. You know, it's like,
they kept dying.
It's like Lord of the Rings
again.
When they
there's no jeopardy.
You could just fly the eagles over and drop the ring in.
Come on,
like,
mate.
You know?
That's not... The eagles couldn't... Hey, listen.
They did at the end, though.
Yeah. But
the eagles
only after the towers collapsed, mate. It's not like... Everyone always says that about the eagles. Why don't you just fly the eagles? It's there from the beginning. Because of the fucking tower.
Why couldn't
the
wizard make a machine gun to shoot all the people?
I'm making a serious point now. Point about Lord of the Rings because the Eye of Sauron
so
is there.
The most sensible
Frodo
way.
Drops the ring.
The most sensible
into the
way of destroying the ring is to
Mount
get
Doom.
The hobbits to trek through.
It's not about what's the most sensible way. It's the idea that the eagles could have just flown there in the first place when there's no the defenses were
why
crippled.
Could they not?
Because
the eagles are massive.
The Eye of Sauron collapses as soon as the ring is dropped into Mount Doom, right? And then the eagles fly in. So it's at the very least, you're a curious
all
man.
All I'm saying
no,
is,
hold on, you're a curious man.
Eagle.
Hold on. You're a curious man. Would you not like to think that maybe the Eye of Sauron did something to keep the eagles out?
I'm sure it did.
I think it did too.
Equally, they didn't try the eagles. I'd have tried the eagles, and then you know you send in an eagle with a fake ring, and then
would have been rubbish. Those films. You can't please anyone, can you?
It would have been rubbish, but it would have been more effective.
Three of the greatest films of all time.
If they had like a Land Rover, they could have just driven all the way there really quickly.
That's true. I mean, especially a Land Rover from a Land Rover advert, because they can get everywhere.
Yeah,
not like a real Land Rover.
Imagine
an
Land Rover
actually can't get everywhere.
I want to remake this.
A mountain and then Frodo Baggins gets out at the top.
I want to remake this, and they've got a Land Rover, and they've stuck like a machine gun on top of it, and then they're just going around and they deliver the ring that way.
Yeah, Rambo of the ring.
At what point do we end up where adverts are just entire films and actually the Lord of the Rings just becomes the Land Rover of the Rings. Yeah, and it's just and that's it. And the whole
Land
thing
Rover
is just a
Rings.
Massive product placement.
Could it drive up the hill that the Sauron eye
Mount
is in?
No, you've got to remember that the eye is really important.
The
eye's
in a tower. Yeah,
the eye's in the tower.
Have you read the books?
I have.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, you make a good point. I accept the argument.
So who else do you think is going to go down with Southampton?
With Southampton?
Yeah.
Or with Sauron? Okay, we're back to relegation scrap time. Now, it's very important for us to reference at this moment in time that the Eagles couldn't get... No, that Leicester are playing Liverpool.
The Eagles are actually safe in the table right now,
yeah,
I believe.
That's true. that's very true. They're not even appearing in our relegation scrap area of the table. Leicester City are playing this evening against Liverpool. This podcast will be out after that, but we don't know the result. You will do. So this may change what we're thinking here. But Southampton already relegated. And as we all know, it is two of Leicester, Leeds, Everton, Forest. Now, we talked about Man City a little bit before. We didn't talk about Everton in that game. I thought Everton were quite good up until the first Man City goal. And then there were two in quick succession and it became a different sort of experience for them. But I watched them in the first 30 minutes and thought, well, that's a team that might avoid relegation.
Yeah, counter-attack was good. A couple of nice set pieces, defended pretty well. Feel like a lot of that was the intensity at which they were able to play, which wasn't sustainable. And also psychologically, when you concede the first Gundogan goal, that's quite demoralizing because it's just so good. And the second one comes so quickly and it's so close to halftime that given that you're probably, if you're an Everton player at the moment, I think Sean Dyche even referenced this post-game. He talked about the games they have after this one. And I think maybe it became a little bit future-looking after that point. And that's fine. But they played well. I feel like I feel like, okay, so they went in at 2-0 down, the game was over, but I felt better about Everton's chances of surviving after watching that half, even though they were losing. Well, I thought they were pretty good.
Next up, they're away at Wolves, and then they're at home to Bournemouth.
Yeah, I think they'll win both of those. To me, it's kind of, clearly they're not very far down their Sean Dyche journey, pathway, motorway, dual carriageway, whatever.
The Dyche deal.
They haven't been on the Dyche journey for very long.
Yeah.
That's probably what I should have said. And yet you see the semblance of organisation already, and you see kind of some basic principles of his football emerging.
Well, the importance of Dwight McNeil.
Dwight McNeil's had a little bit of a renaissance. I feel like Decore has played really well over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
He's become the player he was for about 18 months at Watford.
Absolutely. He looks like Sean Dyche has said to him, you need to run more than everybody else. You need to come off the pitch and fall over.
He's definitely doing that, but he also has these little moments of quality. I know it wasn't this weekend, but his second goal against Brighton was just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And he's such
a smart player.
Yeah, he does so many things well. And that's the kind of player that they bought. A very, very complete midfielder, very complete eight. And he's playing that way, which is a big part of why they haven't really moved up the table. But I think the mood has changed around Everton.
I agree.
Think he probably put Leeds and Leicester ahead of them in the relegation stakes.
Yes. Well, Leeds got a point at the weekend, John, didn't they? And to come, they're away to West Ham, and of course they're at home to Spurs. A little bit harder than Everton's games.
It's impossible to really judge. I think Leeds are a little bit of an outsider in this battle, I think, because we've got a new manager. We're playing very low percentage football, I think. So it's sit deep, try and hit the opposition on the break. And in the game against Newcastle, a lot of people saying, obviously, really good result to get a 2-2 draw with Newcastle. But in many respects, it's sort of complexified by the fact that what we did in that game has stopped Newcastle from being dangerous.
Yeah.
Having said that, we still allowed them to score two goals, and it was unlikely, I think, that we would have scored two goals, and yet we did.
Yeah. Junior Firpo allowed them to score two goals, I think. Well, I don't want to single him out.
But I think he did have a bad, tricky
afternoon.
The overall approach of that game is sit deep, try and hit them on the break and get situations. There's probably five or so situations where Leeds managed to get into their box and we managed to score two goals. That's a return of investment that's a lot higher than you would expect to happen. So going forward, you would look at that kind of game and say, okay, look, 2-2 draw with Newcastle, really good
both
foundation.
Both goals penalties.
Really good foundation to go into the next game and get something out of a team like West Ham, who are focusing more on the Conference League. But I also kind of think that when you play that style of football where you sit deep and you have to make the most of, you know, very few handful of chances that you're going to generate, you're just at you're at the behest of your team actually finishing those chances. And in another world against Newcastle, the ball doesn't get palmed out perfectly to Luke Ayling, or Joel Linton realizes that
Patrick Bamford scores his penalty.
No, of course,
Newcastle don't go down the other end.
But we're talking about analysis here. Right? We're talking about the analysis, and when you analyze that game, it's very hard to say, you know, what should or shouldn't have happened on the basis of the chances, because it is so chaotic backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
And the problem, I think, is that you usually want to look at a game and say, on the basis of the way this game went, we can say this about the next game.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can do that so well with Leeds, because I could see us winning both of the next games. I could see us losing both of the next
I think that's
games.
Really true. Interesting that you apply such nuanced analysis to football, and yet when it comes to Eagles... I'm saying is, a dick.
I just think they should have tried with an eagle first, you know, a decoy eagle.
Nottingham Forest also got a point over the weekend there, JJ Bull. And games to come for Nottingham Forest are as follows. They are at home to Arsenal on Saturday. And in the final weekday, they are away to Crystal Palace. Those are two toughies.
Yeah, the last game of the season is really interesting because you've got a lot of teams who will be battling against each other. I think West Ham play, who are they playing? West Ham Leicester, that's a big game on the last game of the season. Leeds have Spurs in the last game. Everton Bournemouth, obviously Bournemouth now safe, so that's a big one for Everton. That'll be a really fun last day of the season, seeing what all happens
here. I think it will, won't it? I mean, Nottingham Forest are 3 points ahead of Leeds currently. It feels like this weekend's result was very good for them.
I think you can tell how good a team is sort of from their goal difference. I know it's not ideal, but Forest have a minus 31 goal difference.
That's worse than everyone apart from Southampton.
Southampton and Bournemouth, who have a slightly worse one as well. But Bournemouth have managed. I think they got a few batterings, Bournemouth. But
they famously lost 9-0.
So that's mostly why it is. Yeah, there you go. So Forest have done really well to get where they are. I don't know.
I think Steve Cooper's done amazingly well, given what he's...
Gelling that squad is so hard to do.
It doesn't... I'm happy to be correct. It doesn't feel like he has an awful lot of authority about who's come in. And players have just...
I expect he didn't ask for 21 players.
No, you'd imagined not. And these players have come in. Many of them did not have any prior relationship with each other. And they have been able to survive and... not being able to survive. They look like they're primed to survive.
Yeah.
Really good point at Stamford Bridge on Saturday. Mm. Incidentally, I was at our friend Nick Miller's wedding on Saturday.
Oh.
And Nick is a Forest fan.
Congratulations to the Mill man.
Congratulations to Miller the Killer. Mm. He also, he's from a family of Forest fans. And so,
Miller the Marrier.
And after the ceremony, when we were waiting for the reception, it was kind of the second half of Forest Chelsea.
Right.
And there were about 10 people kind of looking at the phones, waiting for the time to tick down. But it was okay because they were all family members and it was all right. And Nick was there himself. And it was.
That makes me think of, I don't know if you've seen the film The Other Guys with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, but there's a very funny scene during a funeral where there's a huddle.
It's not John C. Reilly.
A huddle of suited men. And then two of them are fighting in the middle and they're all whispering and cheer whispering and trying to do a fight as quietly as possible so as not to disrupt the events of the funeral.
The other guys is Mark Wahlberg.
Hmm?
And Will Ferrell.
Oh, yeah, it's not John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
Oh, Mark Wahlberg did a good job.
Imagine that film, though, but with Eagles.
With Eagles.
I'm
going to use my talons to slice open your carotid artery.
We'll see how much gush there is.
Yeah, I think with you, it'll just ooze.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Very
okay.
Cold-blooded.
Now, that's the relegation. You know, who cares? We'll have another break now, and when we come back, we'll talk about whether Sergio Busquets is a rat.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Okay, we're back from a break. We've assessed Steve Hanke's injuries. He'll never make love again. He fell on his cock.
I thought this was the better of the two takes that we've done so far.
Okay, I'll do another one, yeah.
And we're back!
Sergio Busquets, who's leaving Barcelona.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Not retiring. He'll probably end up playing in Saudi Arabia, something like that.
Yeah.
He has been one of the most important players in the club's history. He was part of, like, Guardiola took him from the B team when he took over, put him in the first team when he had that trio that was amazing, of Iniesta, Xavi and Busquets. Busquets, obviously the six, holding it all together. One of the best I've ever seen in that position. He's so important to what they do. He does things like, it might not show up in the data, but he does things where you can surround him with four players ultra and press him at the same time, and he'll find the exact only way to get out of that little cul-de-sac and then bridge everything together. Doesn't go forward too much, really slow, can be quite weaselly, rolls around a lot, pretends to be injured when he's not. But does well, the Dark Arts well?
I mean, is he going to be remembered, Seb, for being everything JJ just said, or do you think he'll be primarily remembered by opposition fans as a, you know, as a Dark Arts expert?
I think it's the whole lot, Joe.
The whole package.
Yeah, because the Dark Arts were part of his game, and I think a lot of people will remember his, as well as many other people's players' roles in that series of games with Jose Mourinho's Real Madrid. But then when I think of Busquets, I probably think of him outside of the kind of awful tenor of those matches and think about like his disguised passing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I used to love about him, and this is something you could probably miss unless you actually look for it, is there's a line of pressing players in his face, and he just made that kind of knifing pass through the middle of the pitch to someone, probably usually an Iniesta type or an overlapping fullback. He made it look so easy. And you had this really interesting contrast between quite a big guy, like a different body shape to Xavi and Iniesta, obviously, and to Messi. And
tall.
Probably just different to what you'd expect from that type of football. Like you have an archetype within there, right? And within the middle of it, you had this sort of, not hulking big guy, but he was a bit loomy, he was a bit physical.
Yeah.
And he was, he looked like he belonged in English football rather than in Guardiola's Barcelona.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because Guardiola now, using Rodri, a very tall player,
exactly.
Got like a back five of all big centre backs, whether intentional or not, it's what he's ended up with. And Busquets plays the Guardiola role. It's the exact same thing. So important in that Barcelona team.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's actually why it's so easy to miss the contribution of someone like that and Rodri, is because you've got these players which naturally attract attention. So at Barcelona, obviously Messi, Xavi, Iniesta, that lot. At Manchester City, you're probably not paying attention to Rodri as much as you are Haaland or Gundogan in this instance. Grealish, players like that, David Silva beforehand. Like these are what you associate Guardiola with, the kind of the technical types and the kind of the players with all the creative flourishes, but none of it really works without them. Probably not a coincidence that this season, for instance, Rodri has been playing brilliantly, actually voted from Footballer of the Year, and Man City are closer than ever before to completing their treble. But Busquets is a marvellous player.
Voted for Footballer of the Year, did you write it on a piece of paper and pop it out the window, or what did you...
No, you get a code. So the Football Writers Association sent you through a voting code, and then you go to their website and you get a vote for the men's award, the women's award, and you enter your code and you enter your names and then you submit.
And you get that because you are a valued member of the community.
I am special, yes.
Yeah, but do you get that? And did you get that?
I do, but I've specifically signed up so I'd be able to vote in it, and I've forgotten to do it every year since I joined.
Right. So are you not a real...
I can't write, so...
You can't write.
I'm not a member of the Writers Association.
He fell off his chair once hosting a podcast.
Yeah. Is there a talkers one? Because I'd like to vote for one. No? Who would you vote for?
I would have voted for John Stones.
John Stones. Interesting.
He tried to lobby me. I was in the office when I was doing my vote, and he was kind of...
He tried to lobby
me
for your vote?
Yeah, no, he was trying to influence. He just kept shouting John Stones at me across the office.
Whispering.
Yeah. Did he throw any stones?
No, he didn't, but verbally he did.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting this year because if Arsenal had gone on to win the title, if they were winning a few weeks ago, then you would have thought, like, I thought Bukayo Saka would be right up there, like goals and assists, tallies. He's been carrying the team. And Odegaard. Yeah.
So that's the 15 goals from the central midfield.
That's it. So I thought, like, those two, I was thinking, it's definitely one of those two. I can't choose which one it is. And I thought, well, it's obviously Erling Haaland. It's obviously him. But it seems so obvious that you don't want to do it. But you have to make sure it doesn't get it.
I think you kind of have to. I mean, I appreciate, of course, Rodri. Wow. Fantastic player. Erling Haaland, though, has scored 50 goals. I mean, hasn't he kind of changed?
Yeah, I mean, when I voted, I knew that Erling Haaland was going to win it. And I remember thinking,
it's like the Oscars, this. People, and then what happens some years is that the one Brexit. That everyone knows that's going to win one. Doesn't win because everyone thinks, well, yeah, of course that film's going to win, so I'll go for something slightly different instead.
It's actually a bit of a selfish pursuit in the sense that I like to think about it. Like, I wasn't trying to be intentionally contrary. I just thought...
You take your position seriously.
Yeah, well, because I always wanted to be a member of the FWA, and, you know,
Football Writers Association.
Yeah, of course. Like, and so you get the vote and you think you take it seriously. And also, I remember it was about 6 weeks ago that I started, ashamed to say it, but I kind of woke up to just how good Rodri actually is. Like, I always knew he was a good player, but I can't remember the game or who the opposition were, but I remember watching him thinking, ugh. You know, fantastic.
I believe in Seb's world as well that he would literally have woken up and just woken up and be like,
Rodri.
Oh my God.
And that's what I said, Rodri.
It's the sort of thing that he would do. Now, does this mean you're writing with a pen and paper?
With a keyboard.
So are you not part of the Football Typing Association?
I believe that that's a splinter organisation. Just, you know, the FWA is like a kind of umbrella. Talking.
Yeah.
Writing. Scribbling. Keyboard.
Yeah.
They must just hate me then.
But I mean, yeah.
You could sign that very easily. They would have you in.
No, they would love to
have
you.
But they have me in.
Yeah.
No.
I don't write anything.
You're part of the football media world.
Yeah, but not in a written sense.
Yeah, but there are lots of people that you... So every year...
They've got to change their name.
Who would you have voted for?
Who would I have voted for?
Yeah.
This is why you can't be invited, you see.
Do I need to vote for a footballer?
Just who do you think has had the biggest impact on the season so far?
Erling Haaland.
There you go, that's fine. Go for it.
Well, I'm not a member.
Normie, isn't it? But
Fred.
Fred. Fridge.
Fridgey.
Yeah, Fridge. Moving on now, time to discuss a quick look back at the Champions... Well, let's not look back because it was such a long time ago, but let's look ahead to the Champions League second round semi-finals of the legs, that second of the legs there. Real Madrid 1-1 Man City, and of course, Milan 0-2 Inter. That was off to a strange start, that game there, didn't it? Now, Tuesday, it's the Milan derby. Seb, you watched and live-blogged the first game of this. I mean, is there any chance for Milan to come back?
I don't think so. There's a chance, but I don't think that, whilst they can probably score a couple of goals, I don't think they keep a clean sheet against that Inter Milan front two with Lukaku on the bench to come on and supplement the counterattack. I thought Dzeko and Martinez were just brilliant in the first leg, particularly the first half, where there was Liam, one of the tactics writers at The Athletic, sent me a quote from Edin Dzeko when he was talking about, from Martinez, where he was talking about his relationship with Dzeko on the pitch, and he talked about how they're always watching each other. They're always reacting to what one another is doing. And it's not kind of a predetermined partnership in the sort of the Shearer Sheringham sense or, you know, and that AC Milan defense showed no signs of being able to deal with it. No. I mean, they could have been three down at halftime.
Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, John, we got some flack last week for saying this would be a snore fest. And you said it largely was, apart from the two goals.
I mean, look, it depends what you enjoy in football.
Yeah.
And I thought it was quite an enjoyable tactical game. Yeah,
I think we suggested that it was going to be a low scoring game.
Yeah, yeah. And look, Milan, I think, got their approach really wrong in the game, and that's why they were absolutely run over in the first 15 minutes of the game. But then I think, by dint of the fact that they maybe changed things up, by dint of the fact that Milan were in a situation where they were in control and two goals up, it meant that they took the foot off the gas a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, really, really, really impressive from Inter. I thought they did a really good job of actually approach. One of the things a lot of teams do in out of possession play at the moment is they'll match up player for player in the midfield area. So we've just talked about Arsenal and Brighton going man for man against Arsenal. Milan were doing the same against Inter in that game, and what Inter were really good at was just moving players around to create passing lanes into the forwards. And that was what really gave them the upside at the beginning of the game. And yeah, it was enough for them to look pretty comfortable. But yeah, it's an interesting one looking forward, because it's only two goal lead going into second half. The difficult thing is going to be is that you can play off the back of that in the way that they played for the rest of the game, which was, we can sit deeper, we don't need to be too aggressive in possession. They've got to try and break us down to get the goals, and if they push forward and leave weaknesses, then we can exploit them. And I think that's pretty much kryptonite to AC Milan.
Is Rafael, is he back for the...
Yeah, I think he will be back. Okay. But even still, I think once you are in that situation where you've got the two goals and you know that you can just double up on that side and make it hard for him in particular, we've seen in the last few weeks Milan haven't been good enough to... Because all teams do this when Leao is playing. But Milan really haven't been good enough at exploiting the weaknesses that opens up on other sides of the, pitch. Yeah, I think it's definitely advantage Inter. But... Yeah,
okay.
Who knows?
Okay, Real Madrid won Man City. KDB, the big boy, coming in, JJ Bull, with a fantastic goal last week. It seems as though it's all sort of perched for Man City to progress. Would you agree?
I don't think it's as clean and clear as that. I think it's really complicated. Real Madrid are one of the best European teams of all time. The last remnants of it now, you've got Benzema, Modric, Kroos, and I think Danny Carvajal is the one that's left over. You could say Courtois has been there for a bit of it as well. So it's maybe coming towards the end of that domination they've had over Europe just by way of having amazing players who can do these sorts of things. and they find a way to get through. John did a really good video on Tifo IRL. You can watch it on YouTube about how Real Madrid keep getting away with this by the, was it relationism versus positional play? And the way they play is, John will explain it better than I will, but that's a really good video to watch and find out more about this sort of thing. City at home will have, this is the advantage they've got, is being at home, so they can then play the way they want to rather than playing away at the Bernabeu when you're playing one of the best teams ever. You have to be really careful with them just waiting for you for the one, like it's even like they lure you in, like they act as though they're not good. So then you sort of stop playing as well as you can in the first 20 minutes and then they pop up with something.
Yeah.
And you've seen it the last few years in a row. It's really odd.
Listen, guys, all I'll say is that I believe last week I said it would be 1-1 in the first leg and then City would win like 4-0 in the second leg. And I
could see that too.
To it.
Yeah, I could see that too. That's the thing. I really can't predict it at all because it could be that Real win it and then City just can't deal with the pressure. But I think because City have come so close over time, you know, they lost the finals last year, wasn't it? Or a year before, I can't remember.
Lost in the semis last year.
Semis last year. Before. Yeah. So like, you know, to be able to win this competition, they've taken like a step closer each time. So like the entire psychology at the club will change. So you know that you sort of belong in that world now, whereas before they were nowhere near it. And obviously their circumstances have changed dramatically with all money and stuff. But now they're just getting ever so closer to it. And once they start to get that, get their first European trophy, you'd think it would be this year. You think it would be. And then that'll be them established as one of those big clubs. And then they'll probably have more over time. When Guardiola's still there.
Ah, indeed, could it be the treble? Now, finally, before we head off, National League playoff there, John. You went to visit this, didn't you? This is what you were buying tickets for during last week's podcast. Chesterfield 2, Notts County 2. But I believe Notts County are through on penalties.
Yes, well, yeah. One, and are promoted because of penalties.
They're through to the next league.
Through to the next league,
that's
yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, and this was, look, this was the most stressful couple of games.
Are Wrexham involved in this conversation?
Wrexham,
why are we
Wrexham
talking about it? That's a joke about the National League, because if they weren't, you know, we wouldn't talk about it, you know, because yes. They're the only interesting
but
team in the.
Wrexham were automatically promoted.
They went up.
There's only one space, therefore.
Then there's all the other.
And yeah, the six teams who play in a playoff, and this was the final of that process. And it was a very stressful for fans of Notts County because it ended up being around 400 minutes of football. They were only leading for 30 seconds.
Well, I can tell you that Chesterfield scored in the fifth minute through a penalty. Mm-hmm. Notts County tied it up 1-1, 87 minutes. That's already scary. Then Chesterfield scored in the 93rd minute, so presumably the beginning of extra time. And Notts County tied it up again. Over 15 minutes later, yeah,
yes. Real it was very stressful.
clutch the
and then John Bostock missed the winning penalty by Panenka-ing it onto the bar.
There was lots of things that happened. So in the first minute of the game, the Notts County keeper took a goal kick and basically dribbled it out.
It was so odd.
So there was a defender in the box, and the keeper took it. He sort of like passed it forward, I think, expecting the defender to run onto it. But he didn't. The defender didn't run onto it, and then the other Chesterfield player was running towards him. So he just had to run forward and kick it, which meant that in the first minute of the game, they had an indirect free kick in the box, where essentially all you need to do is just lay it off, and then someone yeets it at the goal to see. Yeah. And everyone from Notts County is on the goal line to try and just block this, and they'd all just run out. So that was stressful.
Right.
The keeper then clears the striker out on the edge of the box for the penalty. At 5 minutes, and you're thinking, dear me, what's going
wasn't
on here?
It wasn't a great goalkeeper day, though, was it?
No, it wasn't, because the Bostock late equaliser in normal time was from a free kick where he basically just sort of kicked it roughly at the keeper, and the keeper just flapped at it, and it went in. And then there was more goalkeeper shenanigans because their Notts County actually subbed their goalkeeper for the penalties, and they brought on this kid called Archie Mayer, who had two of the best penalty saves I think I've seen live.
Oh, yeah.
The second one in particular, just the sort of splits in the air to.
They Tim Krolled him. They just brought him on specifically
Wow. And then, as you say, made one like that in the 2008 European Championship. It's exactly the same quality with the foot and hand, and you can't quite tell which one it is. Yeah. It's amazing if anyone hasn't seen it.
Archie Mayer is from near where I'm from.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He's very tall.
They make them all sorts
of. He's from Turriff. from Turra.
Is that in Aberdeen?
It's Aberdeenshire. It's a few miles from my house.
Yeah.
He's basically JJ.
He's an Aberdeen youth
JJ
player.
Basically won.
Do you know, I know this guy just checked it now. I didn't realise he's from there. So I was thinking, Archie, I know that name. I don't know why. It's because he was always in the youth teams and like Foot Manager or something like that. And my friend who works at the club told me that this boy is really special and he signed for Norwich when he was really young.
Yeah. What's it like to be proud of where you're from?
I like it. I like where I'm from. Yeah, I love a little village. It's nice, all the people, because you sort of in the village, I guess, everyone knows what you're up to.
What is it? Are you rooting for the other people that live proximal to you?
I don't know. This is a good question. I'm trying to think what it is. Some of my like close friends grew up like next door to me, basically.
Right.
Like, Jack lived up the road, yeah, a few doors up.
Because I hate England.
I left England.
It's really weird, isn't it? How you can live.
What's weird?
If you live in London and you support one club, you can really hate someone who lives in the same city.
The same
support
city.
A different
and
club.
A different club. It's all categorizations, isn't it? What's your main category?
Of what?
Of anything.
Tactics. Like,
is it this? Hello?
Interestingness.
Interestingness.
Yeah.
As in you find other things interesting or?
I think it's more important to be interesting than to be correct, isn't it? You know what I think?
What is it in a kind of print the myth way?
You can talk to someone who is always right about everything and it could be boring, right? But you can speak to someone who's always wrong about something and it's interesting and I'd much rather be in those conversations.
What? Okay, that seems like the opposite of you, though. You seem like you're always right about everything.
You never want to hear my UFO stories.
That's true. They are very boring.
JJ. Oh,
yeah. Of course, yes. That makes sense now.
Listen, one more thing we should do here, John McKenzie. We should say thank you to our new best friend.
Our buddy.
He said we're the best people and wants to be friends with us forever and go to our funerals. His name, Metzenoris. He's a professional Rocket League player who listens to the podcast and who caught up with John McKenzie and we played with him on Rocket League the other day. And
he's quite good.
Yeah, he beat us at the game of Rocket League.
Yeah,
there
was one of him and three of us. And he beat us in all the games.
And
we
you
played.
Play this every single night.
Every day.
For hours.
Well, I mean, you made it sound like a really, really long time.
How long does he play for a day? Does he train? If you're
he said he player? Had. Did he say he had 10,000 hours in the game? Or 20?
20. No, 30.
So for the record, for reference, I've played Rocket League since the pandemic, like that, about 6 months after, 6 months of the way through 2020, maybe.
You played more or less every night as well.
I would say I'd play at least four evenings a week, mostly for like 2 hours in each of those sessions. So let's just say I'm playing for an average of 8 to 10 hours a week, right? Okay. I've only just reached 1,000 hours and I've been playing the game for 3 years. So I imagine the guy has been, it's treating it like a job because it quite literally is a job for him. But it was crazy to play against him. It really gave you an appreciation of how shit you are. It was great. It was like, I don't know, looking in the mirror and thinking, oh, you look pretty good today. And then Brad Pitt walks in the bathroom. Yeah. And then you go, Brad Pitt from Fight Club.
Brad Pitt is a very 90s sort of reference there.
Well, I'm a very 90s sort of guy. Yeah. Which is another reason why we have to end the podcast. That's the end of the TiVo Football Podcast there. Wasn't it nice to have Seb Stafford-Blaw here? And Jonathan Dog McKenzie.
Oh, we're in the outro now, are we?
Yeah, we're saying goodbye. Okay. We've still got to do the intro. We haven't recorded that yet. Man. So just say goodbye quickly.
Goodbye.
And JJ Ball the
Baller. Yes!
Yeah. All right, we'll be back next week with more. But until then, goodbye.
The Athletic.